Hi, welcome to the Four State Podcast. My name is Jim Sulfur with the University of Minnesota Extension. I'm also joined by my co-host and colleague, Fred Hall. He's at Iowa State University and is a dairy specialist there. Welcome, Fred.
Well, thank you. We had a really great webinar with Joel, and I'm excited to be able to visit some more with this podcast.
Yeah, as Fred had mentioned, we're excited to be joined today by Dr. Joel Pankowski from Arm & Hammer. Joel leads and manages a team of PhDs and DVMs, so he's kind of a technical service manager, happens to live out in New York. Joel and I were talking a little bit before we came on this podcast. He actually was in Minnesota at the time I started with Minnesota many years ago. And so it's always fun to catch up with people that you've run across. Joel, do you want to welcome and you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I appreciate it, Jim. Yeah, as you mentioned, I did begin my career with the Monsanto dairy business at the launch of Posilac in 1994. Had a technical service area in Minnesota and the Dakotas. We did a lot of work with the University of Minnesota back in those days in extension service, providing a lot of good dairy management opportunities on farm and with nutritionists and veterinarians in the field. So spent probably 2026 will be 32 years that I've been doing this kind of work. 15 years at Church and Dwight here at Arm & Hammer. I'm currently the Associate Director for Technical Services. I've got a team of 8 multi-species specialists, so veterinarians and nutritionists, and we cover the Americas. So everything from Canada through South America, all species. So I'm dairy focused, obviously, but over the years, I've gotten to learn quite a bit about broilers and swine. So it's been quite a broadening of my career experience here, especially the last 5 years doing the multi-species thing. The rest of my career has been split evenly between animal health and the feed industry. Had the opportunity to do just about everything that you can do in the feed industry. So again, appreciate the opportunity. And yeah, it's good to reconnect with folks that you kind of started out with.
Yeah. Well, Joel, I know you've been doing a lot of work and a lot of speaking on kind of mycotoxins and kind of mycotoxin mitigation. Can you just, for people that might not be familiar with it, can you give us just a little bit of background on mycotoxins, where they come from, maybe wild yeast, but all of these kind of anti-nutritional factors that might be in our feedstuffs, particularly our forages?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. I mean, just to get everybody level set. So what we're going to focus most of the conversation on is the fact that it's kind of an undeniable fact of life that these feedstuffs are contaminated with mycotoxins. Years ago, we used to focus on mycotoxin-contaminated grain, but we've since learned quite a bit and now understand that forages are also very susceptible to mycotoxin contamination. Why is that important? Well, these toxins actually can suppress immune function, which basically diverts energy away from productivity in our lactating cows. So we'll see dips in production, swings in intake, and then gut health issues. So essentially, the goal here is to help the animal mitigate these challenges because the research that we've seen recently would show, oh, upwards of 80% of all the grains the animals would consume would be contaminated with at least one mycotoxin. And forages, both haylage and corn silage, are also susceptible. The second point in this conversation, Jim, is the fact that animals, mature cows can tolerate an insult from one mycotoxin at a higher level much better than they can low levels of multiple mycotoxins. And why is that important? Well, it's important because as we send in these feed samples for analysis, we usually never have a sample come back clean, and we almost never have one come back. It just has one mycotoxin. There's always two, three, four, and they have a synergistic effect. So, in other words, it's an additive effect. As you add more, as you stack more mycotoxins on top of each other, there's more of a detrimental effect to the cow.
So does this compounding also include other insults they could have? I know we just did a program on southern rust. So does that kind of compound with the mycotoxin?
Yeah, southern rust will create issues. There's actually this year in the Great Lakes states a lot of red mold we're finding, and that is actually predisposes animals to be exposed to zearalenone. That's probably, Fred, the one mycotoxin that dairy producers understand the most. It's been talked about the longest because it has a huge impact on reproductive function. So you've not just got the agronomists talking about it, you've got the nutritionists talking about it, and you also got the AI guys talking about it. That's going to be a concern for us this year in any of the dairy states around the Great Lakes for sure. The other thing that they would, that the mycotoxins would have a multiplicative or an additive impact would be pathogens. Any pathogen-type contaminated feed, salmonellas, E. colis, all of these things, when they're put upon the cow and the gut, can impact immune function, and that just drains energy from the system.
So where do mycotoxins come from? From again, just a reminder for people of, they come out of this clear blue sky. Obviously, they've got to be produced by something. So how do we get mycotoxins on our feed? And if you can expand, what are the conditions? Do they grow in storage? Do they grow out in the field? How do we end up with them in our feedstuffs?
So the origins are basically molds that would grow on the feedstuffs. So again, what do you need for moldy molds to form? Molds in your house, molds on your feeds, it's all the same. You got to have high humidity, you got to have moisture. The molds actually produce the toxins. And different molds produce different mycotoxins. So we focus mostly on the toxin because that's the end effect. And yeah, they form in the field, but they also, again, as you increase surface area of these forages, so for instance, you got a stalk of corn and we go out and chop it. As you increase the surface area, you're increasing exposure. Even our best producers, as far as forage management, they get the stuff in the bunker in a timely manner, they get it packed, they get it covered. They still have the opportunity for mycotoxin, risk in those feedstuffs just because it comes in from the field. So yeah, it can be in all three phases. Historically, we focused on mycotoxins in the field. Now that we know more about, where they grow, how they grow, where we find them, we get things pocketed. My first exposure goes back to when I started my career in Monsanto. There were a lot of harvester silos in the upper Midwest back in the day, and it was not uncommon to see high moisture corn come out of those, and it would be blue. It's supposed to be yellow, and it literally would be blue. And those were heavily molded pockets, supposedly in a sealed system. We didn't know then what we know now, but producing mycotoxins, it would have, had a negative impact on productivity.
Now let's discuss it. Anaerobic or aerobic production with the mycotoxins? You mentioned the harvest
Yeah,
was supposed to be airtight.
they need air to grow, that's for sure. Yes, they absolutely need air to grow. The other point I wanted to get to a minute ago was, we didn't see these negative effects as much, quote unquote, back in the day, back in the 90s and the early 2000s, because if you look at the productivity of a dairy cow, again, when Jim and I started our careers, 85 pounds was the goal for a Holstein, right? Now we've got these cows that are, some of them are well over 50 pounds greater than that. There's more demand on the system for energy. And when you have to erode that energy away, the productivity drop is more precipitous. So.
That's kind of follow up. One of my questions that's going through my head, it seems like there's a lot more discussion about molds and mycotoxins. Is that because we have more of them? Is that because we know more about them? And we've just, as you mentioned, we used to feed moldy feed and think, well, okay, it's moldy feed. They might not eat as much. Or is it that our cows are just eating so much more and we expect such higher performance out of them that these little insults just have a lot bigger influence than when our cows were producing a lot less? Or is it a combination of all three?
Yeah, I think the best answer is kind of my guess. My guess when I was going through my undergrad at Ohio State was always all the above if I didn't know, and that's a good answer here. I think it's all three, quite frankly. I don't know. I don't have data to prove this, but I suspect they were always present. We weren't looking for them because we didn't see the detrimental effects. We didn't realize what we had, what we were facing. And you're exactly right. Jim, these cows are producing more milk now than ever, and that means they're eating well more than ever. So the best example I can give you to validate that would be HBS. Okay, HBS is a syndrome by definition, so you have to have a cascade of events that happen in a perfect storm, so to speak, to get a cow to die from HBS. typically in order, it's a mycotoxin installed in the gut that kind of roughs up that gut and makes an open wound, opens up the tight junctions, and then an opportunistic pathogen, an E. coli, Salmonella, or Clostridia type pathogen would take up residence and create a lot of clotting, right? My point is, you never hear about a dead HBS cow coming from the low group. You never hear about a poor producing cow dying of HBS. It's always high producing cows. Well, why is that? They get the highest, they have the highest intakes, they get the highest insult of contaminated feed. So if contaminated feed's laid in front of them, they're going to get a bigger slug of mycotoxins, a bigger slug of pathogens than those cows in the low group.
That makes sense. So let's get on to something. So what do we do about it? I think we've got people convinced. I mean, this is an issue. I don't think any listeners probably think it isn't. So what can we do about it? Either harvesting our feed, bring it in, but if you said it's coming from the field, there's not a lot we're going to do about that. So what do we do? You get out, and then maybe a follow-up question too, Joel, is do you recommend testing for it and trying to identify? Of course, one of the challenges is if I grab a handful of feed, I've grabbed five handfuls, I'm likely to get five different test results, unless I do a really nice job of mixing it. So, or do you just recommend saying, hey, let's just assume you have it. Here's what we need to do to mitigate it. So how do we kind of mitigate through this?
I'm going to answer your second question first. I would tell you that, again, it's an undeniable fact of life that they're present in the feedstuffs. And even our best forage management systems, we will sample feeds and find them, okay? They may be at lower levels, but they're still there. What do we do about it? Well, to your point, testing. Yeah, we can do testing, but again, I have never, all the tests I've ever done and seen from nutritionists I work with from all over the US, I've never seen one come back zero. I have seen tests come back, below the detection limit, okay? Technically that's not zero, but very seldom do you get a sheet where you've got nothing. So even our best managers have a risk. Our stance at Arm & Hammer is a little different than maybe some of the industry. A lot of people that play in this sector, they focus on testing, they provide testing. Testing's expensive. If you look at feed analyses in general on a menu from any of the labs, when you check the box for mycotoxins, it's probably one of the more expensive tests. So it's not one you want to run very often. And to your point, when you look at the data on pile of corn or a big pile of corn silage, it's pocketed. We're just doing random grabs. You got a lot of sample bias, a lot of sample error. You could have a false sense of security when you get the test back, or you could send yourself into a raging panic and make all the changes. And by the time you get the changes implemented, you're already through the problem. So we kind of just say, you know what? We know it's there. We also know that past few years, we've got new technologies available that are very cost-effective to mitigate them through nutrition. And we just say, that's what we got to do. It's a cost of doing business. As we get to a higher plane of production, we've got to do more to help that cow maintain that plane of production.
I think that's kind of what maybe I'm seeing in farms. It seems like it's almost an additive, like you'd put vitamins or something. And I think that's part of it. I used to work in the feed industry, and also when I started in extension, you get called out, no different than you have, Joel, with some troubleshooting. And I would talk to these labs, these diagnostic labs, and said, what do you want me to test for? Because as you said, if you start testing for a wider range of them, it can get really expensive. And then the other thing I guess I've come to the conclusion, I think you mentioned it earlier. Let's use DON as an example. That maybe doesn't have a huge impact on cows, but it's probably means the environment was right for lots of other toxins we don't test for. So I think that's kind of the way I approach it now is let's do, if you want to do a test, do a test, but that doesn't mean you don't have other more nasty mycotoxins, especially if you find a pretty decent level of them, my experience.
100% agree. I mean, just to your point, again, if you look at the literature on all the testing that some folks in it that compete with us do a great job of documenting their surveys. I mentioned at the Four States Conference, DSM does a great job of documenting surveys worldwide. The data that they collect is it correlates very well with published data. Yeah, if you see dawn, then that's the canary in the coal mine, so to speak. That means that the conditions were such that that mold that produces dawn was able to grow, and you can pretty much make the assumption you got something else going on. So that's exactly right. To the point you mentioned earlier, producers don't want to talk about insurance policies because they hate the cost of insurance. They hate the whole idea of insurance. But at the same time, I look at it as it's the cost of doing business at this point. As we take these animals, to a higher plane of nutrition, the rumen's only so big. You can only get so much material through it. It's got to go through at an appropriate rate. It can't go too fast. It can't go too slow. Mycotoxins actually add to feed inefficiency. As an example, anytime an animal ingests something that the body triggers that it shouldn't be there, there's actually proteins and receptor sites in the gut. They know something's not supposed to be there, a pathogen, a mycotoxin. It speeds up, they pull water into the system, it speeds up the rate of passage. That's why we get variable manure. So there's a biological reason for all the things we see on these farms. And a lot of the old timer nutritionists will say, well, let the cows tell you how they're doing. Let the cows tell you how they're feeling. There's a lot of truth to that, but there's a lot of good science behind it now too. Whereas before it was all just intuitive.
Jim brought up Don, and we know that it's happening in dairy cows. How much more exposure compared to aflatoxin, and what does the impact difference look like?
Well, the physical goal result of any mycotoxin exposure is going to be pretty similar. It's kind of like Salmonella and E. coli. If you just look at the animal, you're not going to be able to tell which one it is because they're both going to have variable manure. They're both going to have a variable intake. If they have a severe case, they're both probably going to have a fever. They're going to look lethargic. Same with these molds and mycotoxins. Now, some of them do have very distinctive, they're very distinctive in how they can come in and what they can do. So, for instance, aflatoxin tends to be more of a corn grain insult. It's very, very focused. It's obvious that you can see it. If you do kind of an epidemiological investigation, you can track it down, trace it back, and you can mitigate it very effectively. That type of mycotoxin responds very well to any type of a binding agent, for instance. Whereas zearalenone is an example, different type of mold, different type of mycotoxin produced. Tough to narrow down the sourcing on it, but boy, the results really tangible. Late-term abortions, difficulty getting cows bred. Can't deny when you got that one because you walk out and the animals are sloughing calves left and right. Pretty impactful. In our industry, we talk about if we try to recommend an intervention, whether it be a feed intervention or some kind of a capital improvement, we need a very timely, readily seen result. And trust me, when you get those type of mycotoxin insults, it's a very timely and readily seen result.
Let's kind of shift gears and go more to a discussion of the product. BG Max is a clay-based material.
Well, yes and no. It's actually comprised of two major components. It's got our proprietary refined functional carbohydrates from Arm & Hammer, and basically what that is it's highly bioactive mannanoligosaccharide or MOS and beta-glucans, okay, that are derived from the yeast cell wall through a process that manufacturing, we're the only company that does this. It's called enzymatic hydrolysis, where we can go in and strip off specific components of the yeast cell wall with a specific enzyme. So they decouple from each other and become bioactive, and we have a smaller surface area as a result, and that increases the bioactivity. And then the second component of the product, yeah, it's a highly refined bentonite ground to be at least 75 microns, so a lot of surface area. And it's also been pre-selected to have a high smectite content, which basically is the type of clay that would have a high affinity or high binding sites for aflatoxin, as an example. So with that product, Fred, we go at things a little differently. Again, we talked earlier in the conversation about it, as we learn more, we get more science, we get better, we better to feed the cow, better to mitigate against mycotoxins. In this particular conversation, mycotoxin mitigation at the farm gate has traditionally been with what we call a preventative mode, basically binding them. Well, that works to a point, but as Jim mentioned, these cows get higher in production, higher intake, higher slugs of mycotoxins. You can only supply so much of this binding type material in the feed. and you're still going to have mycotoxin left over to affect that gut wall. So the second component that we add with this new technology is what we call a protection mode. These refined functional carbohydrates, we've been able to show in the literature that they actually have an effect on the gut wall. The analogy I use with producers, Fred, is a PVC pipe. A mature cow's gut is 270 meters squared surface area. That's a lot of area. Just picture a PVC pipe. You want a solid pipe going through that cow. No dings, no dents, no cracks. BG Max helps to make sure that the dings and dents and the cracks are shored up to keep whatever mycotoxins we don't bind, and also pathogens, those opportunistic pathogens that come in our feed, to keep them out of those tight junctions so they can't translocate to the animal system.
Very good. Good explanation. Now, what every producer is going to be asked, what level of product is typically fed to prevent versus treatment, and what's it going to cost per cow per day?
Yeah, that's a good point. Again, we go at things a little differently than other folks at Arm & Hammer. We look at what we would call prevention or maintenance, and we've done dosing studies to show the highest readily seen result, as I mentioned earlier, and the highest ROI. So that would be for BG Max, it's a 28-gram product. So it's a pretty small package size. In the upper Midwest, it's going to probably be at the farm gate for 5.5 to 6 cents a cow in the feed. So it's a pretty small package. And it can do pretty powerful things, again, going through this prevention and protection mode. As we look at diets across the country, this product was actually the result or an innovation that we did at Arm & Hammer as a request of the nutritionists we work with. We tended to see that they stacked products in this category. So, in other words, there would be a moss or a yeast type product in the diet, there would be a yeast culture in the diet, maybe, and then also on top of that, maybe something to mitigate mycotoxins, whether it was aluminum silicate or sodium bentonite or some type of an expensive beta-glucan product. Those three stackings could be 20 to 25 cents. Whereas if we come in with the refined functional carbohydrates and combination with the bentonite and BG Max, we're looking at 6 cents. And then we also have other products you could put on top of that, but you could literally cut your costs in half by stacking two newer bioactive products on top of each other versus the three older technologies that I just mentioned.
So many different products, types of products are out there, because that it seems like it's confusing to farmers. There's lots of them, but do they fall in certain categories? Is and what do the different categories kind of do? I mean, you've touched on that a little bit.
I would say that's a great question. Not any different than like energy products or fat products. Not all bypass fats are the same, but they sure producers still they put them all in the same category. They behave differently biologically. Same with these mycotoxin offerings. I would say one category would be what we would call, again, the preventatives, the binders. And they come in different shapes and sizes, and they can be commodity based or they can be more refined. As with any other feed stuff or feed inclusion, Jim, as you increase the intensity of manufacturing, you increase the functionality. So everything from bentonite to aluminum silicate to yeast cell wall products that would claim efficacy against mycotoxins. But again, they're going to be the 95% of them are going to be tailored towards that prevention mode. Now, there is another second a secondary category I would call would be the ones that are more enzymatic. They're targeted. Highly effective, much more expensive to the producer. It's a great return on investment if you happen to have the mycotoxin that these enzymatic products are targeting, okay, to deconstruct them basically. But if you've got a mycotoxin insult and you just throw one of these enzymatic products at it and you don't have that specific enzyme that they're targeted for, then you're going to be pretty disappointed and spend a lot of money and get no visible result. That's why, again, when we surveyed nutritionists 4 years ago when we started this project, they said, we need something that's multifaceted. We need something that is going to show a tangible result in a timely manner. And we need something that's going to be economical to implement. It's kind of the old theory. You can R&D yourself into the best widget, but if it's too expensive, they're not going to use it. So that's what we did. We were able to combine two technologies into one, kind of an old technology of binding with the new technology of prevention and helping that gut wall, shoring up that PVC pipe. And we're able to do it for, just over a nickel a cow a day.
Great. Well, that's been a lot of good information, Joel.
Dr. Pankowski, would you kind of give us your last thoughts on what you want the producers to walk out of today's podcast with?
Yeah, I think just a couple bullet points. I think first, understand that we have higher producing cows that have a higher plane of nutrition, higher energy needs, and anything that insults the immune system is going to drain energy away from productivity. That's the first thing. Secondly, look at these new feed interventions as what I would call it, if you want to distill it down into a very simple message, they're energy partitioning agents. We're going to provide the animal some help so that she doesn't burn energy and she can use it for what she's supposed to use it for. And that's to put milk in the pail and dollars in the checkbook. That's really important. And then I think lastly, understand that mycotoxins are present. We've got to do something to mitigate them or just become complacent with the status quo, okay? And the status quo would be variable intakes, unexplained drops in milk, variable manure consistency. That's the kind of stuff that drives nutritionists and producers crazy. We can level that variation out with these newer technologies and actually help with gut health in the cow and result in better productivity. So the last point I would make, Fred, is as you're to Jim's point, there's all kinds of choices out there, different price points, different efficacies. If you want to weed through the chaff and separate the men from the boys, so to speak, two things I would recommend. First, if it sounds too good to be true, it's probably too good to be true. If they tell you they've got the best science, the state-of-the-art manufacturing, but they're the cheapest on the market, it doesn't match up. Okay, number one. Number two, my wife tells my boys all the time, nothing in life is free. So you can't cheap out on this stuff. You have to either delegate it to your nutritionist or do a little homework and look at the published science. A lot of companies out there since 2009 will say, when the dairy industry kind of hit the first major economic variability point, have gotten away from doing good science and now they rely a lot on marketing. That's not something we do at Arm & Hammer. This logo carries a lot of responsibility on the consumer product side. We have to follow the same quality control, R&D and technical service recommendation protocols that we do in our human products. So laundry detergents, gummy vitamins, those people that we share those services in our plants. The last thing I'll tell you is look for published science. Look for data. Just don't look for glossy brochures. Make them show you the claim, make them show you the data that backs up the claims. If they want you to spend 10 cents a cow, it might be worth it, but make sure that the science is there and that you can see it.
Dr. Pankowski, thank you for coming on the 4-State Dairy Nutrition podcast with us today. You shared a lot of great information, and we'll make sure that the listeners, if they're interested, they can go back on the 4-State website and look at the webinar we did. We'd like to also invite them on the 25th of November to have come back for the webinar on navigating low colostrum yields with Caitlin Goldsmith from Wisconsin. So at this point, Jim, Joel, thank you very much for working through this podcast with us, and we will talk to you next month.